Good afternoon. I'm going to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Thursday, March 26th. Good afternoon. So we have quite a full agenda today. So we do have a couple of work sessions that we're going to do at the end. And also, if anyone's here to testify on House Bill 2909, we're going to hear that one as the last bill. So I don't even think Representative Lively is here yet, so that's fine. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3057 is you?
No,
3101. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3101. And Representative Post, you can come up with your constituent, and Wendy will give us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3101 permits an individual who has filed a claim with an insurer or brought legal action seeking compensation for an injury suffered as a result of an accident or crime to send written notice to a health care provider to whom the individual owes debt for medical care services, provides the health care provider receiving such a notice, or prohibits the health care provider receiving such a notice from collecting or taking certain actions to collect, assign, or transfer the debt until the later of specified dates, and permits the healthcare provider to collect debt for which the individual received proceeds from the claim or legal action up to the limit of the recovery from the claim or legal action. The tolls applicable statute of limitations on healthcare providers' right to collect during the pendency of claim or action and prohibits healthcare provider from providing reporting individual to credit reporting agency as delinquent in arrears or unwilling to pay a debt. Punishes violation as an unlawful collection practice. The law bill would become operative 91 days after the effective date. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. And there are no amendments.
Thank you. So go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you.
I guess I'm going to go first,
sorry,
if that's all right. Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of committee, Bill Post, State Representative, House District 25. I'm here to talk about House Bill 3101. Actually, I'm not here to talk a lot about it. I'm going to let my constituent and friend talk about it, but I do want to just say this much. This is a bill that will ensure that justice is done, payment for medical bills are made, but it provides a much-needed safeguard to ensure that the lives of victims are not ruined in the process. My constituent and dear friend, Brandon Smith, is here to share his story with you. But I wanted to say first that this bill would not reduce the money medical providers receive. It simply changes the timeline to make sure that the right person pays the bill. Even the smallest provider, I would suggest, is in a better position to manage the float or the cash flow than the victim is. And so with that, I'd like to turn over my time to my friend Brandon. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, appreciate your time today. My name is Brandon Smith. I am a resident of Kaiser, Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3101, and I would like to thank Representative Post and Senator Thatcher for sponsoring this bill, which would prevent healthcare providers from prematurely attempting to collect outstanding balances or turning debt over to a collection agency. On November 12, 2013, I received a voicemail from the chaplain at Salem Hospital that my stepdaughter, McKenna, had been involved in a serious accident. While crossing Portland Road in Salem, in the crosswalk and with the light, a vehicle ran a red light and hit her, launching her 25 feet through the air. She was transported to the hospital with a traumatic brain injury and severely shattered leg and a very bad case of road rash. The driver of the vehicle was cited at the scene for failure to obey a traffic control device, and other legal proceedings are currently underway. McKenna spent the next 9 months going through physical and psychological therapy to recover from her injuries, and given the significance of the incident, it's truly a miracle that she's alive today. McKenna was covered by two health care plans and auto insurance policies, multiple auto insurance policies. We knew without a doubt that there would be sufficient settlement funds to cover all of the medical costs incurred for her treatment. During the months after the incident, McKenna's mother and I worked tirelessly to assure the medical providers that they would be paid for their costs. But settlements do not happen overnight. Regardless, several of the providers sent outstanding balances to collection agencies, leaving a damaging mark on McKenna's credit rating for something that was never her fault. All we asked was that the providers wait for the settlement funds, which were finally paid and distributed in October of 2014, 11 months after the injury, and all the medical bills have been paid. I spoke with others who had the same story to tell. This is certainly not an isolated incident. A childhood friend of mine, John, was on his way to play golf when a delivery truck ran a red light and hit his car. John had a spinal fusion last April, and he expects a settlement on his claims by August of this year. But in the meantime, all the bills have been sent to collections. I'm going to add one other thing that I didn't have in my written testimony, which is that this is not an unusual type of protection for victims or people who have been injured. In my private life, I'm a claims adjuster in workers' comp system. In workers' compensation, when you're injured on the job, medical providers cannot attempt to collect payment until all litigation has been resolved or exhausted, and then they can attempt to collect from the injured worker. So this is not a unusual concept. In speaking with Senator Thatcher's chief of staff, we understand there's also other states that have similar types of legislation to prevent or to protect victims. In closing, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time, and I ask for your assistance in protecting the innocent victims of accidents and crime from additional financial injury. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have a technical question that probably is best directed at the representative, but thank you so much for sharing your story and bringing this forward. I've looked through the bill, this also might be a good question for other people who can testify. Is this saying they can't send that to collections, or is it removing some requirement or trigger in the law that says they have to, that maybe like certain medical bills have to be paid within a certain year, with certain times where they have to send it to collection, or is this just saying they can't? Do you understand the distinction?
I'm going to actually, Brandon, you want to answer that? I think it's actually, he knows it better.
We actually have had that discussion, thank you.
Okay.
And we've talked about a time frame, and there was not a time frame built in the initial draft, and so that's something that I think could be considered. The intent, and I believe the language is in the draft, is that that upon proper notification to the providers, that there are these insurance policies or settlement proceeds expected, that then they would be required to wait for that to be exhausted. I don't believe there was any time frames built into this, but that's something that certainly could be given as far as perhaps a length of time from when the injury happened, whether it's 60, 90 days, something like that, for the providers to be given notice, and then they would hold off or would be asked to hold off sending it to collections until all the proceedings have been exhausted.
Thank you.
I would just follow up by saying, yeah, we've talked about we would like to hear everybody, what they have to say, other folks in the industry and whatnot, and certainly open to some fixes if necessary. Yeah.
And this is in no way, like Representative Post said, this is not an attempt to keep any medical providers from being paid for their costs.
Yeah.
I believe in personal responsibility, and when there's costs incurred, those need to be paid. This is just simply a timing issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Rayfield.
And I think it's a great bill. Some of the things that I've actually seen is where you have a medical bill that's submitted to a collection agency or somewhere else, and actually the provider gets less because there is insurance out there. So the provider is actually in the provider's best interest to hold on to it, but sometimes there's some interesting procedural things from a third-party billing entity that's not really thinking in the best interest of the provider. Some of the questions that I had was more or less on subsection 3AB, which was just kind of the timing of things that, I was kind of curious as it was on the basically when the provider, however, would be able to collect, because I think that's important. It says the date on which an insurer allows or denies the individual's claim for benefits under an insurance company. And I was curious what allows, because sometimes you can have an insurance company that will accept liability under a situation, but they haven't settled the claim. And so, or sometimes, so there's kind of a little bit of a distinction there in the insurance industry side. And so that language to me is, I was kind of curious what that was intended to represent or what it does mean.
I didn't actually participate in the drafting of the language.
Okay.
And so I couldn't really, I think, speak to what the intent was there. From our experience, there were because there were multiple insurers involved, both auto and health, it created some overlap, and that does create some confusion. I can't speak to the actual, as far as the time frames and what was intended there, though.
And then one follow-up?
Yeah.
And then is there, sometimes what can happen in a case is a case is pursued, let's say that the medical bills are stayed and they're not being pursued at that point with the anticipation that there may be a settlement. At some point, the party that doesn't believe they're at fault decides to withdraw their claim. Do they have a notice requirement to notify the provider that they are withdrawing the claim? I didn't see anything in the bill, and that would be or is it just kind of a common interest where the provider might just contact that party, say every 30 days, hey, what's the status of this claim and where are we at?
Well, certainly the contact is something that definitely does happen.
Yeah.
We hear from both the providers and the collections on a regular basis. Like I said, I would agree there certainly is some amendments or changes that could be made to put some protections in. We're not interested in harming providers.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further questions for this panel? Okay, seeing none. And Arthur Towers, do you want to come up? And you can stay, Representative Post, cool. If for no other reason than I may never see you two at the dais together again.
Can we get a picture now?
Yeah.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And many members of OTLA fight for consumers, like the gentleman to my left, as they struggle with both the trauma of what's happened to their families, as well as the challenges they face working with and sometimes struggling with the insurance industry at the same time. We strongly support this bill. We really commend Representative Post for bringing this forward, for fighting for the little guy and standing up in this sort of situation. Under current Oregon law, the incentives are not strong enough to prevent the insurance industry from delaying and denying and delaying and denying and delaying and denying settlement of claims. And even when they're acting in good faith, as it sounds like they are in this case, the delays can be lengthy. And so this is a very good bill providing relief to consumers, and we strongly support it and again commend the sponsor.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Towers? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And Buzz Matson. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Buzz Matson. Thank you, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. I'm an attorney with Professional Credit Service in Springfield, Oregon. Professional Credit Service is a collection agency. We work to promote the goals of ethical, compassionate, and effective collection on behalf of the businesses whose customers and consumers reside in the state. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, which I'm the first vice president of. We don't believe that House Bill 3101 we believe it's a well-meaning bill intended to aid consumers whose medical bills resulting from a personal injury case or who are victims of a crime that required medical care, places unreasonable restrictions on health care providers, financial services staff, and restricts how they can work to collect those. Collection agencies, ours in particular, work with healthcare providers around the state, and we dedicate staff to shepherd special cases, including personal injury matters, crime victim accounts, and workers' comp counts through the collection and payment process. For example, our company, Professional Credit Service, has two employees who do nothing but work personal injury and crime victims and workers' compensation counts on behalf of the medical care providers. These employees are experienced in working with personal injury attorneys and are familiar with the laws governing crime victims. other agencies in the Oregon Collectors Association perform the same service for their clients. What is probably most helpful is that those trained people are dedicated to helping the consumer solve a problem they may not otherwise be able to solve, whether the consumer has their own lawyer or not. The collection agency representatives balance the needs of the health care providers and the patient, the victim, or the consumer, while keeping the consumer or the consumer's attorney, in the case of a personal injury matter, advised of the progress from the health care provider's side. Often our representatives will advocate for the consumer's needs and circumstances with the health care provider. I've personally observed this process with account balances as low as $1,000 and as high as $440,000. I saw them all be guided to a resolution that both sides were happy with. This proposed legislation would take a service out of the hands of a trained representative, add new duties to the medical care providers, patient financial services staff. We could see some amendment where we have no objection to the restrictions of the time frame that's placed in the bill. Were the bill amended to allow collection agency, the healthcare provider's agent, to work under these particular restrictions of the bill, we would think it's terrific. But it, just as a matter of imposing it back on the healthcare provider, we think we are against the bill for that.
Thank you. Questions for yes.
And I've actually dealt with some of your staff on some of these issues, so I wish they were probably a little bit more favorable than the examples you gave. But the first question that I would have is, what is the structure of the deal that you have with your provider? So a provider has a $1,000 bill. When they submit the bill to professional credit services and then you collect on that, what is the
structure? We're a contingency collection agency. We don't get paid. We get paid a portion of what we recover. Given the way technology works and how you can be much more efficient with computers, it's becoming a relatively small portion, but we get a portion of what's recovered.
So just a follow-up. So the provider actually gets less than the full amount of the bill at the end of the day?
Yes.
Okay. And then the last follow-up. Do you report when something gets submitted to you and it goes into the collection agency and someone is unable to pay because they're in, you know, facing, do you report this to a credit agency?
If it's in a particular category, like a personal injury, we do not. Okay. If we have just a medical bill where we have no notice of any particular circumstances, we report, as the new IRS rules dictate, at 180 days. And then we will delete that after the bill is resolved.
Just to make sure I understand properly, so on a case that would be subject to this bill, you wouldn't report it until 180 days?
No, we would not. At all? At all.
Okay. What was the, I guess I just want to make sure.
The IRS is, and under the ACA, has issued new guidelines in a publication called 1075 that they do not want medical bills reported until 180 days have passed, become 180 days past due. And then that after those bills are resolved, that they be deleted from the consumer's credit file.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Other questions, Representative Holby?
I'm curious, in your process of collecting debt, do you ever assign the debt to anybody or any other person to collect?
No, sir. Not at our firm.
You don't hire attorneys to collect your
debt? We have three in-house attorneys.
Do you ever hire outside attorneys to collect debt?
Not within Oregon. We actually have attorneys in our office licensed in 9 states. So out of those 9 states, we work the cases ourselves. In other cases, we do. In other states, we do forward to those attorneys.
All right. Thanks.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mattson.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard in House Bill 3101? Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3101. And I'm going to open concurrent public hearings on House Bill 2252 and House Bill 3057. And I think we'll start with Representative Holby. Do you want to start with your
sure.
LA? Want to give it the summary?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2252 establishes requirements under which a debt buyer may bring legal action to collect debt, including the notice that the debt buyer must give to the debtor. makes a violation unlawful collection practice. The bill increases the time period during which a debtor may bring action for unlawful collection practice and increases the amount of damages the court may award. It permits the court to award attorney's fees and costs to the prevailing plaintiff. It permits award to prevailing defendant only if the court finds the plaintiff did not have an objectively reasonable standard for bringing action. There are no amendments before the committee at this time.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly on House Bill 2252. It does have a history in this building. It has been before the Consumer Protection Committee a couple of times in previous sessions, and so has been a topic that has been talked about for quite some time. In the world of debt collection, just looking at from to the Attorney General's consumer complaint hotline, their top one in their top 10 lists, debt collection is always one of those higher ranking practices that receives complaints to the Department of Justice. So we've looked at that over the years, trying to figure out how to minimize these complaints and really look at what causes these complaints. And in the world of debt collection, we also have debt buyers, which actually buy the debt from somebody else, and then they become first-party debt collectors as opposed to third-party debt collectors. And I'm sure the debt collectors probably don't like me saying it quite that way, but in fact, their practices are relatively similar. And for a consumer, they don't really distinguish whether it's a debt collector, a debt buyer, or a private attorney that's trying to collect the debt. They're just faced with trying to get through that process. And what we've noticed, from many of the complaints is that people don't even know that they owe a debt. They're not oftentimes notified that they owe a debt. And oftentimes debt collection process is started on these individuals when they don't actually owe the debt. And so it creates a lot of problems for consumers in trying to deal with that. They can turn to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which is the regulatory agency over debt collectors, but does not currently have any authority over debt buyers who actually own the debt. That's not just something they can do. They can contact the Department of Justice, who will take their complaint and log it, but they don't actually represent individual consumers and helping them recover their money or protect them if statutes have been broken in trying to against the consumers by the either debt buyer or debt collector. So we looked at this issue and tried to come up with some requirements that would help solve some of these misunderstandings that happen with consumers in this world. And, you know, fundamentally, we think debt buyers should be notified or should notify consumers before they enter into an action against those people so that they know what's going on to start with. And they must, it seems like they also should be able to verify what debt is owed. And does this person really owe the debt? Has it been dismissed in bankruptcy or some other mechanism? And those things don't seem to happen. And it really puts consumers at a disadvantage because they can't get help from the Department of Consumer Business Services. They can't get help from the Department of Justice. And quite frankly, they can try to hire an attorney, but most attorneys won't take these cases because there's no money in it for them, and there's also a great risk to the consumer of owing attorney fees to the debt collector. And so a lot of these cases just never surface, and there's tons of complaints that maybe are never really documented that are happening in this world. And it's something that I think this legislature has struggled with year after year and has not been able to get protections for consumers in this field. And so I have been down this road for many years, and I hope that the chair is able to, you know, come up with a positive outcome out of this for consumers. And with that, once I started this, I kind of started it on introduced this bill previously on behalf of the Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee. But I also am glad that I brought it forward again. So I would like to introduce you to my staff, the real Robert Unger.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Robert Unger. I'm Paul Hovey's legislative assistant. So about 2 months ago, I received a notice that I was being garnished for my wages. This was a writ of garnishment from Clackamas County Court that came through Employee Services. This was the very first time I had heard of this. And so essentially, you know, not knowing what the process was, I called the law firm and was able to ascertain the last four digits of the Social Security number, and they did not match mine. And so essentially went down to Employee Services and found out that not only had I had a notice of garnishment, that I was being garnished for the previous 2 months. So at this point, I was up to $1,500 that I had taken out of my wages. We were able to stop the very last check, but the other was already given to the law firm at that point. And so in sort of working through everything, we found out that it was a different Robert Unger from a different part of the state. They had taken out this action against him, and when doing the search for collecting on the garnishment, had somehow found me, forwarded this to Employee Services, and they didn't really receive anything other than, I believe, a little bit of the Social Security, and so they put it through. So, you know, essentially, since that point, I found that this has probably affected my credit. I'm still sort of working that out, but it's looking like it has probably hurt that. It's been over a month since I've asked for the first $1,000 back and still has not received that, although I believe Employee Services said they think they have a check now for it. So we'll see. And, you know, just the amount of time this has taken to me has been one of the worst things. And I'm lucky that I don't have any children or a house payment. I mean, that could be, you know, quite a hardship. And I guess I'd like to reiterate that, you know, it's to me, I didn't know this debt, and after bringing these actions against me, there's really no liability to these debt collectors. And at that point, I really don't have a practical legal recourse, because without prevailing attorney fees, I really can't get a lawyer to take the case with the amount of money that they would be liable for. And really, I think this kind of harkens back to this lack of notification issues. We believe that there's really no obligation to the employer to notify the garnishee. And, you know, almost assume that they probably had thought that I had received notification from either court or the law firm or even Midland Funding, who brought the initial debt collection against me. And so, you know, really, if we could make sure that these prevailing fees are there and that there was recourse for someone in my position to amend the situation. Thanks for your time, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Well, that just sounds awful, but it kind of sounds like they also messed with the wrong person, because what is the chances that he would be the LA of somebody who,
yes,
who and, is know, a champion for these issues?
To that point, you know, it probably helps that Robert is in my employ, and he would have a better access to solving this problem than many other Oregonians do. And that I know from talking to other Oregonians who've been down this road, who really just get so frustrated with trying to straighten out errors in debt collection and not understanding the rules that apply to debt buyers versus debt collectors versus attorneys that collect debt. And it is a real troubling aspect of law, and I really think that we need to holistically deal with these practices and put some good standards in place so that consumers are not the ones that are getting hurt when they are virtually innocent.
Yes.
I'm just kind of, if you could walk me through, or maybe how this bill would help your situation, or would have helped, or maybe even prevented this.
You want me to try that?
Yeah.
he might be able to do a better job than I am, because he's been studying this a lot more lately for some reason.
Yes, I have.
Become an expert.
I think part of this bill, you know, has a notification that you actually have to notify somebody 30 days before bringing a legal action. That would have helped in his case, and that's a big deal. And they must also, in the bill, you know, be able to identify that you actually, that, you know, there's a statement that shows the amount that was last paid on the debt, the balance due on the debt, trying to establish what the debt is and where it comes from. It's not, you know, the consumer should know that and should be notified of what that is in case it's a dispute. Or say he actually did owe this debt and had a canceled check that he actually paid it. They never checked that, you know, with him. And so there's actually no process for him to go, wait a minute, I don't owe this debt. Or maybe he declared bankruptcy after his last divorce, you know, and had this dismissed in bankruptcy court. Was that ever checked? You know, there's a lot of situations that could arise where had some of these little basic steps at the front end of going through this action against a consumer could have stopped this in their meantime and not sent a consumer through hours and hours and hours of trying to track this down, having to take time off of work to deal with this, and, you know, being really at a disadvantage because he's dealing with attorneys and he's not an attorney. You know, and so I think that those are some of the basic elements that are really fundamental to this bill, and you know, the ability for him to get representation is really important too, I think. So,
and I probably should say for the benefit of the committee that we're opening these concurrently because we actually have been conducting for, I think, over a month now, a large working group with industry and consumer advocates to actually try to come to a place of compromise to actually move something forward. We think that 2252, because of the broad relating to clause, will be the vehicle that this, that kind of components of this other bill will be amended into. But I appreciate you creating that vehicle in 2252, and thank you for telling your story. Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thanks.
All right, next I'm going to have David Reed, Jan, I think it's Strong, I don't know that I read that correctly, and Sonia Gibson. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Sure. You would like us to talk on both bills?
Sure. Okay. Or just, you know, and just in the progress of the working group, et cetera. So.
Okay. Just want to start off by thanking Chair Fagan and the members of the committee for this opportunity to...
And identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes. David Reed with DBA International. I'm Director of Government Affairs for DBA. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for DBA International, which is the national nonprofit trade association for companies that purchase performing and non-performing receivables on the secondary market. They're frequently referred to as debt buyers or debt buying companies. And we are here today because we want to see consumer protections, enhanced consumer protections adopted in Oregon. DBA International has no tolerance for companies or bad actors that try to harm consumers. It's a position that we've had, we continue to have, and will always have. Consumer protection is good for the industry. Consumer protection is good for the consumers. We were here in 2013 testifying on a similar bill to 2252 wish to find a solution in this legislative session that we can get something adopted. DBA International has, you know, as I indicated, has a long history of advocating for consumer protections. One example is our national certification program, which we launched in 2013. It requires all of our member companies to be certified and adhere to best practices within the industry. Out of the 29 standards, I think approximately two, maybe three of the standards are based on existing state and federal laws and regulations regarding consumer protection. All of the other standards go above and beyond that which is required by state and federal law. For that reason, our program is considered the gold standard within the collection industry because it is so rigorous in its requirements for the industry. And it also includes independent third-party audits to ensure that companies are complying with the standards that we have adopted. DBA also has a long history of working closely with legislators, regulators, and consumer groups in promoting and supporting consumer protections. The only thing that we seek is that the law or regulation that's adopted be fair and balanced, designed to protect the legitimate interests of both the consumer population as well as the business community. DB International does oppose 2252 as it was introduced, but that's not because we don't support consumer protection. It's the provisions that are in the bill, the way they are worded, extreme and in some cases impossible to comply with, and they're dropped into the Oregon Unlawful Collection Practices Act, which is a strict liability statute where, for example, even if you have a required notice that you have to provide and you forget the word "the," that's a violation of the statute. So that's the reason why we have concerns with it, because it's being dropped into a strict liability statute without any provisions for inadvertent clerical errors or things of that nature. Because of that, we decided that for this calendar year that we would try to be proactive in Oregon and promote a solution that we thought would resolve the problem. And that's where we asked for House Bill 3057 to be introduced. And that bill would have brought the debt buying community, which is the only difference between a third party collection agency and the debt buying community is one holds title, the other does not. And that would have brought the debt buying community under the auspices and regulatory control of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, if I got that correct. And it also would have actually granted the director of the Department of Business and Consumer and Business Services to be able to identify a certification program such as that DBA International has and require those elevated standards across the board for any debt buying company that operates in the state of Oregon. We felt that that was an approach that would have resolved the issues in the state of Oregon. Obviously, 2252 was reintroduced as well. And at the request of Chair Fagan, several weeks ago, she asked if we would be willing to sit down with her and the industry to try to, in an effort to try to combine what we were trying to accomplish in 3057 and 2252 into a single bill that the industry could get behind, that the consumer groups could get behind. Over the last 3 weeks, we've been up here every single week meeting with Chair Fagan and hearing what the concerns of the consumer groups are, trying to incorporate it into draft language. And I think, we were here on Tuesday, and the chair had a list of items that she wanted to see incorporated. She thought we were getting close, and we've incorporated all those items into it, and we transmitted the draft yesterday. So obviously, I'm sure the consumer groups and the chair maybe hasn't had an opportunity to review it yet, but I think we're close, if not there. And I have to say that, as in, I guess, any type of negotiation, there are things in the draft that we have right now that I can tell you DBA is probably not happy about. I'm sure the consumer groups aren't happy about, but the bottom line is we can live with it, and it does increase consumer protections, and I think that is a successful outcome where all parties can get behind a bill draft and support it. So I'll just quickly, I guess, identify some of the things that are included in that bill draft currently. It would include provisions that would provide clarity that debt-buying companies are included within the Oregon Unlawful Collection Practices Act, which also includes a private right of action. It would prohibit filing suits when a debt is beyond the statute of limitations. It would require the Federal Trade Commission's asset decree notice be provided on out-of-stat debt. It would authorize the Attorney General to prosecute phantom debt collectors and also authorize the AG to prosecute for violations of the Act, even if the person contacted was not the debtor in question. We added that at the request of the Attorney General's office. I guess there's some case law that would run counter to that. And we were surprised by that, and obviously we would want the AG to have full ability to handle issues like that under the Unlawful Collection Practices Act. The draft would also allow the Department of Consumer and Business Services to require debt buyers to be compliant with industry certification standards. It would expand the items that would be included in the initial correspondence with the consumer. So we're talking about the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, a federal law that has an initial correspondence requirements, that what has to be contained in initial correspondence. It would increase the information that's provided in that initial correspondence. It would also prohibit the sale of any debt where the debt-buying company has not responded to a consumer's validation requirement, which is very important to DBA. It's actually one of our standards that a debt-buying company cannot sell a debt that hasn't been where they haven't responded to a consumer's request for verification and validation. It also would require debt-buying companies to provide to the consumer the contract, a summary of post-charge-off accumulation of interest and fees, as well as a chain of title on the debt when the consumer requests that information. And debt-buying companies would have to cease collection until they are able to provide that information. So obviously a lot of consumer protection built into the draft that where we are right now. And we, DBA, is prepared as it's drafted right now to support it and issue a memo of support and do anything we can do to assist the passage of that. At this point, I'll just turn it over to Jan Steger, who's my...
Sorry. Your handwriting's about like mine.
Who's my executive director of the association, who will talk about some of the national things that are going on in the area of debt collection on the national level.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Chair Fagan.
I'm going to pull the microphone over to you just for the – we can hear you fine, but for the recording. And keep it about 6 inches from your mouth is perfect.
It's okay. I get this all right. Thank you, Chair Fagan, for having us here today and for the opportunity to talk a little bit about what is going on the national level in the debt collection, debt buying market. And I know that you guys are probably familiar that the debt collection market is heavily federally regulated. We're covered by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, as well as the FCRA, the TCPA, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, the Service Member Civil Relief Act, the Bankruptcy Code, and several other laws. So it is an industry that is regulated fairly heavily at the federal level. We also now are regulated under the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Formerly, we were regulated under the Federal Trade Commission, and now we have two regulators. And recently, we've actually been beginning to be regulated or have guidance issued on the industry from the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, is now also stepping into the area, as well as the FCC. So there are a lot of agencies overlooking the industry. The CFPB is, you might be aware, under some monumental rulemaking process of the FDCPA. It's a very outdated law that needs to be updated and needs the industry is in full support of the rules being updated and rules being issued, because what the industry really wants is clarity. We want to know what you want us to do to legitimately collect debt. Do you want us to leave a telephone message? Do you not want us to leave a phone voicemail? Would you like us, you know, what do you want in a notice? Do you want pages and pages of disclaimers, or not disclaimers, but statements out there for consumers to read? Or is it better for us to refer consumers to a website that lists all of their rights and their protections and things like that? So I think what we are looking for really, truly is clarity and guidance, and so that there's no intentions of breaking the law by the debt buying community, the legitimate debt buying community. And so what we're really looking for is clarity. And that is why you'll see, like, just these intense negotiations over every word, is because we want to make sure it's crystal clear what you want us to do and how to act, so that we can legitimately go about the collection of debt. And, you know, have the right person and do everything so that the consumer is protected, but the business goes on. I don't think I need to talk about, you know, the importance of the industry and the effect on the economy and stuff like that, but it is an important aspect of the credit reporting agency. We're serious when we talk about how we work with people we work with regulators to make sure that there are consumer protections. Just recently, we worked hand-in-hand with the FTC in developing guidance, because in the phantom debt arena, they believed that some of the areas where the data was getting into the hands of criminals, and I'm not going to say debt collectors, they are criminals, was that it was being obtained through the purchase and sale when a portfolio was put out for bid for a sale, that it was getting into the wrong hands. People were getting that information, whether it was redacted or not, and then going out and collecting on what is identified as phantom debt. We worked with them very closely on about 10 or 12 measures on how you can secure that data and how you can vet the people who can see the data and how you destroy the data afterwards, so that we protect that consumer information. We also work very closely with the FTC and the CFPB, to the point where they redline our certification program, each version of it, and say, we'd like to see enhancements here, we would like to see adjustments here. Attorney generals do the same. As a matter of fact, your attorney general's office here told us we'd like to see Standard 1 revised to include bankruptcy, and it now includes bankruptcy code as a stated law that they would be to abide by. So I think we're very serious when we talk about how we're willing to sit at the table, we're willing to hear the concerns, and we're really willing to work on solutions to what the concerns are.
Okay. Thank you. Sonia?
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. My name is Sonia Gibson. I represent Encore Capital Group, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2252 as it's originally drafted. By way of background, Encore is the largest purchaser of charged-off consumer receivables in the nation. In Oregon alone, we have 234,000 Oregon consumers that have an account with us, and we believe we're setting the way for consumer-centric focus. We have the first-ever industry Consumer Bill of Rights, which you'll have a copy with you, and part of our commitment to consumers is to treat them fairly and with respect. And we do everything from not charge any interest and fees to not reselling accounts to providing significant discounts on all of the accounts that we interact with. So as Jan mentioned, we are regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as well as the Federal Trade Commission, and we take laws and legislation and regulation very seriously over our industry as well as in our interaction with consumers. We support responsible legislation, but we believe that legislation should be reasonable and something that we can adhere to. I want to first start off by thanking Chair Fagan for convening members of our industry and other stakeholders and to work towards a regulatory framework that is reasonable, and we think we're very close, as David mentioned, so I really appreciate that opportunity to come and speak to the concerns. I will, however, highlight some of the concerns with the bill as originally drafted, just so I can have on record what the initial concerns are. You'll have in front of you written testimony as well that covers some more of the concerns that Encore has. So I'll start by describing there's a data and documentation requirement in the bill that simply is impossible to meet, and that's because some of the documentation does not exist in the normal course of business, and the banks themselves would not be able to provide such documentation. So the banks, under federal law and their federal regulators, must only retain documentation for 24 months. And so there's a requirement for pre-charge-off itemization as well as a copy of the contract to be provided to consumers. And because of this retention policy, debt purchasers cannot get that information from banks. Additionally, the copy of the contract, more and more consumers are opening up accounts over the phone or online, so that typical signed application or contract just does not exist anymore. What we actually propose to include is a charge-off statement, which Encore provides to our consumers. The charge-off statement is the document that banks provide to their consumer 180 days after delinquency, and it's highly regulated by the Office of Comptroller of Currency. It includes the charge-off balance, what type of debt it is, who the retail company is, for example, all of the consumer information, et cetera. And we feel that's a reasonable document that and statement to provide that shows the evidence of the debt. I want to also talk about the statute of limitations provision in the bill. There's statute of limitations in 47 states is really covering the ability to litigate. And what the bill does is actually expand statute of limitations for collection activity unrelated to litigation. And we feel this is actually going to end up hurting consumers because consumers who, after statute of limitations expires, may be looking to contact us and looking to resolve an obligation they see on their credit report, and the bill would prohibit us from being able to contact or speak to them. So we think it'll have some unintended consequences because they wouldn't know that working with a company like Encore could actually help them regain their financial footing. I want to also talk about the account-level affidavits. The bill calls for an original creditor account-level affidavit to be provided. This is not only very difficult to do, but near impossible. We think that providing an account-level affidavit from the original creditor is a vehicle for using debt purchasers to regulate the banks. Essentially, we would be required to go to the banks and have them create an affidavit for every single one of the accounts that they sell. And banks sell tens and millions of accounts. So it would be an impossible standard, and it would be actually the first state in the entire country to have such a requirement of debt purchasers, thereby eliminating our industry's ability to litigate on valid accounts. And really, litigation is a very last resort for us, but like any other contract, that is a right that you have when you have an outstanding obligation on a contract. So again, I want to thank you for your time and consideration and for the ability to provide comments. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have and very much looking forward to working to an agreed upon bill that's very reasonable.
Thank you very much, and I do want to attest to the fact that I really appreciate you guys having come forward in good faith in the negotiations that we've had in the work group, and I do appreciate that. I can certainly say that I have seen evidence of the fact that you really do care about consumer protections, and I greatly appreciate that as we've negotiated through this. So we will do a couple of questions, but just so you know, we have 12 more people who want to be heard on these bills, and most of them are people that are not in the Capitol for any other reason than to be here today. So let's do a couple of questions. Representative Holvey.
I'd just like to clarify. They were speaking to an amendment that I don't think is in OLIS, and so I just want to make sure what we're, you know, when they were referring to their proposal, you know, I don't know that we are certain what that proposal is. So I did get this from the Debt Buyer Association this morning, and so I don't know if this is the amendment they're talking about. I don't know. Can you add clarity to that?
Certainly. So we're not to the point yet where we have fully drafted an amendment because we've had a couple back and forth, but I agree with Ms. Gibson that we're very close. I just haven't had a chance to go over their last draft with the consumer group, which I'm assuming we'll do probably early next week. So there is no amendment yet because we really just wanted to have one gut and stuff amendment once we kind of come to an agreement to put in to be able to have everybody get behind. So I think that when she is referring to a particular document, the reality is just kind of referring to the negotiations that we're working on to come to a compromise, pulling a lot of what's in, you know, a lot of the spirit or the letter of a lot of what's in 2252 is actually will go into what we think we're working to as the ultimate amendment. I don't know if you want to speak to that as well.
Yes, that's my representative.
And so a question around that, because I think I had time just to, over about 10 minutes to look at your proposal, and it appears that your proposal is just adding debt buyers to the Oregon Unfair Collection Practices language, essentially, as well as recognizing your certification that you want to evidently be licensed as well through Department of Consumer and Business Services. And maintain your industry-recognized standards. That's kind of what I'm seeing in the bill.
Representative, what you have might not be, because definitely the negotiations that we're worked to is a lot more than that. That might be an earlier version or something. I'm not sure what you're looking at.
Okay.
Yeah, the last version is dated 325 on the bottom.
Okay, I must have an older version. Apologize.
And I'll be presenting their new version at our next consumer group meeting.
Well, it'd be helpful if we were all on the same page with what we're talking about.
Right.
So.
Yes, quickly.
I would echo Representative Polby. It'd be helpful to see what we're actually looking at. Some of the things that are very important to me is verification of the debt prior to filing a lawsuit. And so some of the things actually in 2252 make a lot of sense to me that you'd have to verify beforehand, because those are the things you'd have to prove in court. Right, and so you can't pursue in court without actually having a lot of those things in 2252. So as you go forward, please consider my interests on that. The other thing that I think is very important is the attorney fee clause. Right now, it's very difficult to find attorneys that will take cases like this, where someone has been a bad actor. And you guys are the good folks, right? We're not here talking about that. And so I think that's really important. And so I wanted to, and you had mentioned there's a private right of action. I wanted to ask, is there for the defendant in this action, who would be the consumer, is there an ability for them to recover their attorney fees?
I'm not sure the answer to that. I'd have to check on that.
And again, that's something that's very important to me, so please consider that as you go forward throughout your discussions.
Representative McLean?
Well, I wanted to understand I understand that there's some material that's very difficult to get, but I wanted to understand if there was still at least some notification in the amendment. Because I had thought that at least one of you had been in my office and talked about notification that your company already does.
Yeah, there's multiple notifications. Currently, the FDCPA requires notification to the consumer at the initial point of correspondence, and it lists what needs to be included in that correspondence. That goes out, whether it's a collection agency, a debt buying company, a collection law firm, that goes out to all consumers. What this bill would do would enhance that by adding a couple of additional items that need to be included in that initial correspondence. It would also require a new notice that is only required in, this would be the fourth state to add it. It's called the Federal Trade Commission's asset decree notice. So Oregon would join California, Connecticut, and West Virginia be the fourth state to require that. It's a requirement that the Federal Trade Commission wants to see all states have, and that basically addresses the issue of out-of-stat debt and basically your rights associated. So.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you guys coming forward. So we're going to move forward. Is Representative Evans still? Okay, great. You go ahead and come up, Representative, and Michelle Freed and Brett Knutson. Go ahead and name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I apologize for being in and out of the committee.
Oh,
we've got a house next door of veterans very motivated. So that's, and as irony would have it, that's actually why I'm here today to talk to the bill. I'll keep my remarks relatively brief. I don't have a lot of the technical aspects. What I'd like to talk mostly about, and again, for the record, I'm Paul Evans, House District 20, representing Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem. I spent 20 years in the military, 10 operations, 4.5 years in combat zones, in places we can talk about and some places we don't talk about. What I can tell you about is the impact upon some, I don't want to cast aspersions, this building, people get in trouble for that, but some bad actors in the predatory credit market. There is, in fact, a federal law that was passed to try to protect military members and veterans, but that law has holes in it the size of M1 Abrams tanks. And the reason that we still have a problem with it, especially in Oregon, is the following. We don't have an active duty base culture. We have a National Guard state. We have no active duty bases. That's actually important because when you have states where there are active duty bases, you actually have military veterans organizations that are integrated and available. And while we have a few around the state, many of them next door, trying to make their case about lottery funds and other things, the fact of the matter is we have a nation that has forgotten we're at war. And since 2001, we've sent close to 3 million people across the world. We've had 400,000 women veterans made since 2001. In Iraq and Afghanistan alone, we've had about 2.2 million with about 280,000 women veterans made. Why do I say that? I say that because we think they go, they come back, and then they reintegrate. That isn't actually how we fight wars anymore. Some time ago, we decided we can do everything on the cheap, and we've done a pretty good job of that. So we've been fighting the same war with the same folks. That means you go deploy 2 and 3 and 4 times. What that means, deploy, by the way, what that means is that you train, you get your folks ready to go for maybe 6 months, 9 months, a year, depends on the service, depends on the mission. You try to get the family ready for being gone. Your focus is doing whatever you need to do to get to that moment so that the family's taken care of, spending whatever you got to spend to throw money at the problem so that the kids have what they need to have, so that the spouse has what they need to have, maybe even a holiday that you can't afford, but you don't know if that's going to be your last one. Then you spend between 6, 9, 12, and sometimes 18 months, depending on, of course, the needs of Uncle Sugar, time overseas, trying to catch up where you can via computer capabilities and your mission, which, by the way, if you think that going away you're really gone, you don't understand the process. Because now, because of things like this and because of computers, you're never really gone. You can come back from a mission, your spouse expecting to talk to you because you said you could talk to your spouse, and the spouse is doing all the things that are normal in an everyday American life. They want to talk about little Johnny and how come little Johnny got in trouble, or how come little Sally had stumbled and broke her leg or something. And you do what you can to get through it. Then when you get back, you go through a period politely called reintegration. Now, it is difficult to explain, but I can tell you in my own life, as a twice-divorced guy who made lots of mistakes between deployments, if you have continual or multiple experience that can leave an impact, whether you actually end up with PTSD or whether you end up with military sexual trauma or whether you end up with just a very hard time, when you come back and try to reintegrate, again, money sometimes is spent on things. Sometimes when you try to reconcile the bills, you try to reconcile the checkbook, you don't know where some of these things have been. And then because, again, we haven't made the military much bigger, we continue to fight with the same folks, then you never know if you're going to get deployed again. And if you do, then it's through the whole cycle. I say this because there's some statistics out there that are telling us a story. And I don't want to draw the connection that one causes the other, but they're correlational. I happen to believe, because of my own experiences having to do with credit and having to do with a divorce and then being laid off when I try to get back into the workforce, that when you get behind on certain types of bills, some companies make their money on going after the folks that are not exactly thinking straight. And I can tell you, as a person who had to go through the VA for help and assistance, not every decision I ever made was terribly bright, but you try to make amends and you try to live up to your responsibility. And that actually means a lot to military folks. You try to pay your bills. You try to make progress. And some of the systems that are out there, or at least some of the actors that are out there, make a killing off of some, shall we say, shadowy practices. We have a suicide rate among veterans that is twice the national average in some places. We have a significant rise in women veterans incarcerated, and we've continued to watch an increase of men veterans incarcerated. I'm not here today to say that credit practices made those numbers. What I am here to say is if you actually want to make a fundamental difference in the lives of countless veterans and families, helping find a solution that's workable in the credit area will be one less thing that's on their plate when they try to reintegrate, one less thing that can separate a family, one less thing that is a problem that may help a person decide to drink one more drink because they can't make sense of it. You have a really an important role here to try to get this right and to try to make sure that there's one less thing affecting the folks coming back. So that's really my message. I don't have a whole lot of specifics about which bill is good. It sounds like everybody's coming together and compromise is helpful, but I'll try to answer any questions you might have about at least the veterans' perspective.
Well, thank you always for your service, and thank you for your testimony as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead and go.
Hi, thank you, Chair Fagan and committee members. My name is Michelle Freed. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I have perhaps a bit of a unique perspective because in my practice, I regularly represent consumers, but I also do represent creditors. And so I do both sides of the fence. And I'm here in support of House Bill 2252. In my practice, I regularly represent consumers that are subject of debt collection activity or have been sued. And it's on a debt that they don't even recognize at this point. By the time these debts are packaged and sold and then resold, who knows who the plaintiff is? And the consumer, the balance may have changed so much from that credit card the consumer had 4 years ago that they don't even recognize the balance and don't really have a place to start. Many of these lawsuits, these debt collection lawsuits, do just go straight through to a default judgment with that consumer having very little information at all about them. I believe that requiring debt buyers to have sufficient supporting documentation that the consumer can review is critical for the consumer to make an informed choice about how they're going to handle this debt or this collection effort. Do they need to file an answer and litigate the claim? Do they recognize it now, and do they need to make a settlement? This documentation that 2252 requires, I believe, is pretty basic, and I believe that it's part of a creditor's due diligence. I think that this is something that, as a creditor's attorney, I always look for and make sure that I have before I would undertake any collection efforts on an account. We're asking for the name of the original creditor, the charge-off date, the charge-off balance, date of last payment, a breakdown of interest and fees assessed on an account. Giving this information to a consumer, the consumer can look for issues like whether the account's past statute, whether there's impermissible fees that have been added to the account, and help the consumer both recognize and verify that balance. Often I see that these debt collection lawsuits are filed without the plaintiff having access to this information. As an example, I have a client who I was representing. She was sued for two different accounts simultaneously by the same debt buyer, so two pending circuit court cases. I requested verification of the debt, and the plaintiff was never able to obtain any verification. So as a result, the court eventually dismisses the case because of lack of prosecution, and my clients spent money on me, got no information about the debt, and then these same accounts pop up months down the road. So I think the effect of House Bill 2252 will require debt buyers to have this information beforehand, before they engage with any Oregon consumer to collect on a debt, basically have their ducks in a row, have the information that they need should they need to litigate a claim. And I think this is a needed protection for Oregon consumers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brett Knutson, and I am from Washington County, and I represent debtors who get sued on these collection lawsuits. And I strongly support 2252. And there's a lot on my mind about what's being discussed here, but hopefully I can make a couple of comments. One is that these are largely credit card debts, and these are sophisticated debts. And it's easy to accomplish overreaching without regulation. And the FDCPA has done a great job of regulating the debt buying industry. And you can see that in the comments made today by that industry saying, look at how good we are behaving. And that's because the FDCPA is a strong tool and it requires compliance. Otherwise, there are effective lawsuits that these consumers can bring against the debt buyers. So this notice requirement, I also want to make a point of, it's only triggered by instigating litigation. So the debt buyers can do whatever they want outside of litigation. But once they decide to sue, they have to give that letter 30 days before bringing a lawsuit. And that's the point at which this debt becomes something that a consumer can voluntarily pay on versus involuntarily having to pay because they are sued and they lose the lawsuit. So it makes a big difference in that consumer making an educated decision about whether to pay that debt or identifying defenses with that information provided and asserting those defenses, hopefully without litigation. Hopefully before the lawsuit's filed, they can resolve their differences. There's a lot of comments that I'm hearing about the difficulty of getting this information, but this is a very sophisticated industry. They are making very sophisticated purchases with banks, and I'm certain that they can identify requirements in those purchase agreements that will allow this information to be provided by the banks. So charge-off information, they get that information because they insist on it, and they get this media, for instance, the charge-off statement, they get all that. The additional information, such as the principal and interest that has accrued on the account, is something that they can require the banks to provide in these sales. And eventually this will become routine. So I'm not concerned that they can't, that this information is impossible to get. I've subpoenaed banks to get the information because the debt buyer won't give it to us in lawsuits, and that information has been available. So for instance, and it is difficult for some of these consumers to respond to the challenges when they get sued. Recently, somebody was, a client of mine was sued by a law firm. She knew that this wasn't her account because her landlord had her information had been stolen from her landlord's trunk. So she got the lawsuit and she went to the lawyer and said, look, here's the information I have about why this is in my debt and why I don't think it's, and then she asked the lawyer to provide information about the debt so that she could identify defenses. This is sent to the wrong address. I've never lived here, for instance. The response from the law firm was simply fill out this debt affidavit and or else we will continue to prosecute the case. She filled it out. They rejected it. It wasn't good enough for her, for the law firm. So they required her to go to the police, get file a police report, get that information. She provided that to them. She said, I can't provide you any information about the debt you're suing me on because I don't know anything about it. Eventually, they did agree with her, and they dismissed that lawsuit, which is the proper thing to do. But they put the burden on her when they should have had that information available to them. So that's my comment. As far as enforcement, this act is probably completely unenforceable if it's reciprocal attorney fees because it's an unknown act. It's going to be very risky to bring a lawsuit to recover $200 if you're faced with losing and the substantial attorney fees for having lost that. So there's going to be no incentive by the consumer to enforce the act. That's the importance of this. If this was information, or if this was 10 years down the road, it may be less important because everything's been resolved and we know where the gray is and where the black and white is. But early on, no one's going to take that step to enforce these rules without that protection.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Very quickly, we have nine more people who want to be heard.
And actually, before you leave, I have a quick question for you brought up the attorney fee issue, and I'm curious how you get paid in these situations and what is the incentive for someone to hire you or not to hire you?
Sure. There's a couple of different ways that we get paid in these situations. I think I'm maybe a little bit of an anomaly. I don't know that my colleagues that are here do these cases as much as I do. I will have a client pay me a couple of hours of time to do this initial step, appear on their behalf informally, request verification, and help the consumer suss out what is this debt, is it legitimate, do they owe it, and if that's the case, then work with the consumer to settle, to get on payment terms and that sort of thing. If I can look at it and say, well, based on everything you're telling me, I think this is past statute, or I think that there is a consumer case there, and if I can bring a case under a consumer protection statute that carries a right to attorney fees, I will absolutely take those on contingency. But I'm just not in a position to do that otherwise, and I would never advise a client to do that if the client has a risk, if we really think we've got a claim, but if the client has a risk of being on the hook for the collector's attorney fees, there's no way I'd advise a client to do that.
And it's a good question, and often I've taken cases where I've been paid a small upfront fee, but I've taken that case because the debt collector is clearly overreaching, and I'm not going to win that lawsuit, and I'm not going to get paid on it. There might be a right to attorney fees for correcting that overreaching of the debt collector under the FDCPA, but in order to establish that the debt was a $4,000 debt, not a $7,000 debt, that consumer is not going to receive representation. If there's no representation establishing that overreaching, then it'll go to a judgment. And once that judgment is entered, it essentially declares that action by the debt collector was legal and that the $7,000 was the correct amount. So it kills a subsequent FDCPA case. So it's a big problem.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next, how about Kelly June?
Jones, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I actually, you know what, your handwriting was fine when I rewrote it on my sheet, so that one's totally my fault.
Well, I wouldn't be shocked to find.
Richard Lewis, and is that you?
That's
right. And then we'll also have Pam, and the last name I don't think I can get, but Pam from District 20. Looks like E-R-A-Y. Is there any, Pam, anyone in the first name? Oh my gosh. See, so that's his fault. Because he looks like Pam Array, not Paul Evans. Okay.
So I hope you don't give me a bad time for misreading names in my career.
If you had to read some of these handwritten ones, we could go to task
me,
on this. Okay. Great. Go ahead, Kelly and Richard.
Thanks, Representative Fagan and
thank
the rest
you.
Of the committee for letting us talk today. I'm going to just introduce myself, and I'm going to let Rich speak for a while because he's a real person, unlike myself. I'm a lawyer, so I think his testimony will carry a bit more weight. I'll just start out by saying that I call myself a consumer rights attorney. I do a lot of what Mr. Knutson does, and I kind of consider him a mentor when I broke into this field. But largely what I do is, you know, anything to do with consumer debt. So when you're getting sued on a lawsuit, I defend if I can, and we can talk about that more later, similar along the lines of the other two attorneys, and bankruptcy when that's the option, and then sometimes initiating lawsuits against debt collectors when they do bad things, when they break the law. And I'll talk a little more later, but typically always under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and there's reasons why that I'll address when they come back to me, but I'd like to cede to Rich to tell his story.
Hi. I'm Rick Lewis, Washington County. My story's been told here already by better speakers than I. I got phone calls, I got a letter, I got sued. I had no information that was given to me pre the suit. I was wise enough to answer the suit, go down to the courthouse, pay $180 to answer. I was wise enough to ask for discovery and get back a packet of information that was confusing. They first told me it was from one bank in the information, and then in a secondary part of the paper, it was another bank. So I went from U.S. Bank to Key Bank in the same information. And I don't recall any of this at the time. But I had to actually ask hard to get anything. So here I am with a guy who's not going to make millions.
Thanks,
Rich. Go ahead.
Questions for Rich?
Yeah, questions for Rich about his experience?
So I just like to kind of clarify, and thanks, Rich, for coming down here. Obviously, it's a long trek from Portland. It's hard to get real people down here to the Capitol, so as you may well know. And just to kind of put facts in there is Rich was sued by a debt buyer, tens of thousands of Oregonians. I think Encore's representative said they have, 200,000 plus accounts just in Oregon. That's just one debt buyer. So you can understand the scale of how many Oregonians are sued each year in Oregon courts by these debt buyers. So Rich did what a lot of consumers may not have the ability or gumption to do. He scraped up some money to go, pay the answer fee, filed an answer, because there's no information in the complaint he got other than here's the step buyer I never heard of, and allegedly here's a U.S. bank account that you owe us. That's it. Okay, nothing, no documents attached to a complaint. They don't need to be. This is part of why this bill is important. So he pushes and pushes and does some discovery, which is, you know, pretty brave and takes a lot of gumption for a consumer and non-lawyer to do. He asks for a request for production. Eventually, they give him some documents. In those documents are several things that they have, the bottom line of what they typically are able to produce. Right? There's some statements. It's a charge-off statement. Then there are some assignments, some general bills of sale from one entity to the other. This went from allegedly U.S. bank to another debt buyer. That debt buyer sold it to this debt buyer that's suing. Sometimes we see like five in that chain, four, five, six even it could happen. But in this one, it's three. And in there, there's a statement saying, here's the last charge-off statement. Well, that statement's from KeyBank. So they're suing him in the complaint saying you owe to U.S. Bank. And there's another piece of paper that says, you know, with the information, his Social Security number, his address, and U.S. Bank's the original creditor. There's no interplay between U.S. Bank and KeyBank. So who Rich owes, if anybody, is still unclear, and that's pending litigation. This bill would help prevent that. And this isn't a rare case, and we heard testimony earlier. I don't remember his name, but I think your assistant. I mean, it just shows you the odds, right, that that's going to happen. To all our family members, friends, talking hundreds of thousands of lawsuits, how many of them are reduced to judgment on debts that people don't owe? Who knows? We don't know because it all takes place with very little interaction. And I'd like to touch on the attorney's fees. Talk a little bit about them. I think Mr. Newsom said well, and why that changing the to prevailing plaintiff is so important. Okay, and I know this is a controversial, but it really shouldn't be, because although it sounds like an issue of fairness, if you just look at it simply, hey, you file a lawsuit, and then whoever wins, they should be able to get their attorney's fees. But this is a consumer protection statute, and I'm aware myself of no other consumer protection statute across the country. There may be some in some, you know, Mississippi or somewhere else, down in the South or something that does. We have our own Unfair Trade Practices Act that has the same thing. This was addressed years ago for that consumer protection statute. All the federal statutes, all the consumer protection statutes have attorney fees to the prevailing plaintiff. The defendant, the debt collector in that case, they can get their attorney's fees if I, as a plaintiff's lawyer, file a frivolous lawsuit. Okay, and there's nothing to support, and it should be that way. We shouldn't be filing frivolous lawsuits, and hopefully that doesn't happen too often. But the reason that we have the prevailing plaintiff fees, okay, why it doesn't shift normally, is because it's meant to be a private attorney general statute. So the DOJ, DCBS, they do the best job they can, but they're inundated. So we need these statutes so that attorneys like myself and the others that were here will enforce the statute, okay, and also the consumer to actually stand up for the rights. Because as it is now, what happens when I go to a client or a client comes in and there's a violation of the OUDCPA, right? So there's $200 statutory damages. Let's say there's no actual damages, emotional distress, that type of thing, no punitives. There's just a violation of the statute that needs to be enforced. I have to tell that potential client, well, you could get $200 out of this, and you're doing the right thing, and you're standing up for your rights, and that's, you know, helping to deter an effect. But there's a risk. There's always a risk in litigation that, you know, a jury could not decide in your favor, and we could lose. Well, what does that mean? Well, that could mean, you know, anywhere from, you know, $15,000 to $80,000 in corporate defense fees. Would you sign up for that? I mean, I certainly wouldn't. And so it's chilling the statute completely if we don't correct that. And that's the reason most of our lawsuits that apply, we're going to bring them under FDCPA if we can, because it has that non-shifting of fees. So until that gets changed, it is a problem, and it's a very important part of this statute, amongst the other things that I think are really going to help Oregonian consumers. And the statute as a whole, you know, it's not about lawyers. I'm a lawyer. This really will help Oregon consumers and you know, tens of thousands of them a year, just to empower them to get the information they need to try to reach out to the very few attorneys that are out there that may represent them, whether they're going to pay the money up front or not, so that they know, do I owe this debt? Should I just get into a settlement plan, or should I fight this because it's past the statute of limitations because I don't owe the debt, like Rich doesn't? I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thanks, Rich, for coming all the way down here. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we're going to have Tom Davis, Brian Fair, and Sybil Hebb. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
And thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. My name is Tom Davis. I'm an attorney from Beaverton. I've spent 33 years doing many creditor-debtor actions, the last 15 years perhaps more doing more creditor-type claims. Representative Rayfield, you've brought up about the attorney fee issue, and maybe I could just address my thoughts regarding that issue. Specifically, there are several areas of existing law that provide for attorney fees. ORCP 17 provides sanctions against attorneys who file frivolous claims, who falsely certify that something is accurate when it is not. ORS 20.105 provides attorney fees when someone brings a frivolous claim for which there's no basis. There are also many nuances of ethical complaints that can be brought against attorneys who bring fraud or frivolous claims. HB 2252, where it addresses attorney fees and interest, may have conflicting areas with other areas of the law. For example, on the interest, where it limits the interest to a formula. Heaven knows, anyone trying to do that formula at any given day, it's just a prime area for mistakes to occur. 82.010 does provide how interest is to be calculated. It's at 9% unless it's by contract. I guess I would suggest I'm a firm believer in individuals being held accountable, whether they be maybe those few within the debt collection industry who cross the line. They should be nailed. The other part of it is debtors who owe a debt should be required to pay. And if creditors must bring a claim in order to get paid, and they have to pay their attorneys to bring it, if they prevail, attorney fees should be awarded. Just as if a consumer or a debtor defends on a claim that is found not to be valid, then that consumer should get their attorney fees. Mm-hmm. I trust and believe in our judiciary to do what's fair. I mean, they're there. They make decisions. And that's why the general rule is if you win, then the other side should pay your attorney fees for making you jump through all the hoops to get there. Courts don't sign judgments without proper service. Employers, in trying to honor garnishment laws, need to identify the proper person who owes. And, for example, often that's through Social Security numbers. And if an individual has their check garnished when it's not their debt and it's not their Social Security number, that's not a problem with the statutes or judgments that got it to a judgment. It's a problem with the employer who should have double-checked the Social Security number before trying to withhold. I've seen some of the language in what's been referred to as a compromise amendment, and I didn't participate in any of the discussions of how that arose, but I do see some things that I find appropriate. And part of that deals with bona fide error. If someone makes an unintentional Scrivener's or almost just minute mistake that doesn't hurt anything, that should be excused, regardless if it's the employer who made a goof and didn't garnish, unless there's some sort of ill intent. I am a little concerned about some sanctions against individuals who own a debt. I mean, it's not a collection agency, but we've got to be careful that we also don't violate or conflict with the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, because if someone owns that asset, then they should be able to do things with that asset. It just, in this arena, it happens to be a debt. I conclude by saying there's numerous sanctions available against unscrupulous attorneys or collectors. I trust the judiciary to enforce it. I also, in representing consumers, I do many things where I meet with people, I explain the law. If the debt's not owing, under there are several statutes by which we proceed, and the trier of fact will award attorney fees in favor of the debtor. I note, for example, 20.080. It's just an attorney fee clause that says, and its companion that says, hey, if you have to file a suit or defend a suit where the amount in question is $10,000 or under and notices were given, if you prevail, you get your attorney fees. And that's including if you are defending. Yeah.
You? Nope. No, I see.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Keep going.
Chairman Fagan and the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Brian Fair. I'm a debt buyer from the state of Washington. My company's name is Fair Resolutions. I just real quickly want to caution everyone a little bit about collection laws and what the impact can be with consumers when you add restrictions on their availability of credit. And there was actually a recent study done within the last year by the Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, and it found that each additional restriction on debt collection reduced recoveries by 9% and lowered the number of credit cards available to consumers by 2.2%, and it was the high-risk borrowers that were most impacted. So please keep that in mind as we go through this process. I also want to point out I'm a board member of DBA who testified earlier, and I want to tell you that the certification program has some real teeth to it, and I realize that this committee hasn't had a chance to dive into all the requirements it takes for a debt buyer to be certified, but they are rather onerous. And one very specific to Oregon that you should pay attention to is one on vendor management. As debt buyers, we just can't police our own companies. We have to police whoever does work for us, be it a collection agency, be it a law firm. We are now in charge of that process in our certification program. And that had a real big, that would have had a real impact in Oregon a few years ago. There was an attorney, and I won't name him, he's deceased now, out of Eugene. That was disbarred. He was buying debt. He was litigating debt for debt buyers. And had our program been in place back then, I think we could have protected, prevented the action the Attorney General had to take. I also want to point out, since July 2003, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been taking complaints, and those are available by state. There's been 761 complaints filed at the CFPB by Oregon consumers in the debt collection area. Only 13% of those were against debt buyers. Of those 13 points, 11 points were resolved to the consumer's satisfaction. I know Mr. Unger testified here earlier about a garnishment. I don't want to go into the actual garnishment process, but I want you to know that when it comes to verifying debt, we have to be very careful that we don't send Mr. Unger the statements or contract information of the other Mr. Unger. We have privacy issues, so we have to be very careful when we're verifying debt that we don't send the wrong person the documents of another, especially when it's the same name. The litigation letter has come up. I want to tell you, I used to actually send those letters. You're not going to get a response. I'm telling you, I was hoping that it would get a response, that would lead to settlement. They're not going to get a response, and that's my experience. I heard a talk of KeyBank and U.S. Bank. KeyBank credit cards are actually underwritten by U.S. Bank, and it's right there on their application. So the statement will come from KeyBank and will be serviced by KeyBank, but actually U.S. Bank is the creditor and does own the debt. I know, Ms. Hebb, you're going to speak. I just want to tell you that if debt buyers are filing lawsuits in the state of Oregon without appropriate documentation, I will be your expert witness.
Nice. And we will have that recorded.
It is recorded.
And that's what I mean. This is all recorded. Thank you very much.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today. In support of 2252 and then also just speaking generally about some of the issues that our clients have seen related to debt collection. And I very much appreciate the attention and all the time that you've all given to this issue, and many of you over many, many years. And I really appreciate this conversation. As some of you know, the Oregon Law Center is a legal aid provider. Our mission is to help low-income Oregonians achieve access to justice, and just a significantly increasing number of our clients have come to us seeking assistance because of debt collection issues. Obviously, the economy has hit people hard. That's exacerbated some of those circumstances, and so we have become more concerned about these issues. I think it's really encouraging to hear that folks on all sides of this discussion have acknowledged, of course, that there are individual responsibilities to pay debt, and also that there are legitimate business practices in collecting debt, and that from all perspectives, we want to make sure that that's handled in a reasonable and responsible way and facilitate the practices of the good actors and prevent the practices of the bad actors. So I very much appreciate that. I appreciate the voice of industry concurring in those principles, and that's what we want to be a part of. I just want to give you a little bit of a glimpse of the kinds of issues that come through our offices. I'll give you an example of a case that I think illustrates some of the concerns, and then I'll get specific about the most important pieces, I think, of the discussion from our perspective. So I think there's sort of two categories. From one, the biggest, largest category, I think that it sort of comes up at the beginning of any case, it's related to communications and notice, and kind of what sort of information do you get, what sort of information is provided to the debtor, to the consumer when receiving notice of a lawsuit or prior to that point. And I really echo the comments of the consumer advocates who've gone before me, is that if you don't have adequate information, you can't adequately assess are you on the hook or not? How do you respond? What are your options? And so the more information that can be provided, the sooner in the process helps consumers take steps forward that make sense. I think that also inures to the benefit of the people who are trying to collect the debts, whether they're collectors, original creditors, or third-party debt collectors, because if you have the accurate information, a consumer is more likely to be able to identify, is this legitimate? Okay, then here's my one course is to start paying. My other course, if it's not legitimate, is to contest that or to dispute that. So the issues can get resolved and people can move into their the next stage of the discussion more effectively. A specific significant issue I think that needs to be recognized both within the context of communication and then also in the context of what kind of accountability exists is when a collector is attempting to collect a debt that is beyond the statute of limitations. It's clearly egregious behavior if that's happening and the person knows that it's beyond this and they have an obligation to know whether they're attempting to collect a debt that's beyond the statute of limitations. And I think it's important that the consumer be provided information about that issue when they first hear from the collector. I wanted to also just indicate that I think that statute of limitations issue is larger than just the statute of limitations, because it goes to whether or not you've got a valid debt. And there are lots of other ways in which a debt can be invalid. It might be prohibited by law to collect a certain type of debt, or there might be other issues related to maybe the debt doesn't even exist and it's not the right consumer. I think our current act does not protect effectively against those kinds of practices. And if a collector knows or should have known, has any reason to know that they're trying to collect a debt that is invalid, I think that needs to be specifically prohibited. It's not currently addressed effectively in our statutes, and I'd like to see a protection added there. So maybe it makes sense for me to go through my my list, and I think
actually, could you?
I could be quick,
or we very quick, because we still got four more people who need to be heard, and we have really 5 minutes left in the hearing, so okay. Very, very quick.
Okay, so the only two other things I would make just clarify is, or sort of focus on is I think that a lot of what we're talking about goes to this business model practice from some of the bad actors that is based on an assumption of default judgment. And I think that the prevailing plaintiff attorney fee, the lack of a prevailing plaintiff attorney fee, helps make that assumption and that default judgment practice profitable, and it's what allows that default practice to be to work. And I think that's something that it needs to be taken into consideration when we're looking at trying to shift the balance of power and even the playing field. I think that's the. I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. So I know that. Cheryl, you had a constituent, Ann, is it Nagel? So go ahead and come up, and then Cheryl, you can come up with her, and Eve too. But I want to, is there any other constituents or people who aren't normally in the Capitol who came today to be heard on this? I saw Young. Did you not want to be heard? Okay. So great. So we
can do it.
And then if you guys can give Cheryl, or not Cheryl, but Ann most of the time, and we know some of your concerns. I'm also going to leave the record open until 5 o'clock tomorrow. So if anything's been said that you've heard that maybe you want to respond to, you can submit written testimony that we'll make sure is part of this hearing, and we'll leave the hearing open until tomorrow at 5.
If I could just apologize in advance, I have to leave at 2:45, and it has nothing to do with what you're about to say.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Oregon Department of Justice. With me today is Eva Novick, sort of our expert in this area, and one of our consumers who is brave enough to bring her story to us on our consumer protection hotline. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Nagel.
Thank you all. I'll try and keep it quick. There's a lot of moving parts to this. 2 months ago, I was contacted by a process server who wouldn't give me any identifying information other than I was being sued, and gave me the phone number to the judgment enforcer on a credit card debt, so-called credit card debt. I called to find out what the situation was. You know, no one wants to hear that they're being sued, especially for something that you don't know anything about. These people were aggressive and said that they had sent me a letter in December with a 30-day time frame to respond to the letter. I never received the letter. I would have received it over the Christmas break. I would have remembered that. So the whole notification thing is only good if you actually receive the information. So over quite a time frame of this conversation, this person kept putting me on hold to check with their legal department to come back, just get more and more intimidating with me. And I kept saying, you know, I don't know who you are. I don't know what this debt is. And he just kept coming out saying you had a credit card back in such and such time. Well, that would have exceeded the statute of limitations. And I said, I do not have this credit card debt. I don't know what you're talking about. And he said, well, if you're working, so we're going to start garnishing your wages unless you agree to a stipulation of agreement for payment. And starting to go through my mindset of, I don't have any paperwork. That was from 15 years ago. 10 years is how long you need to keep financial documents. So I have nothing to validate that I don't have this debt. I can't afford an attorney. And so then I said, well, you know, the so-called debt has exceeded the statute of limitations. And he says, no, it hasn't. It's valid. It's accurate. You need to set up a payment arrangement. And I said, well, I can't. And he said, well, you're married, right? And I said, yes. And he said, well, then we're going to sue your husband. Not only are we going to sue you, but we're going to sue your husband. We're going to put a wage garnishment against him, repossess his car, and put a lien on your home. And I said, well, you can't do that in Oregon. Oregon's not a community property state, and he has nothing to do with this debt. And he says, oh, we can and we will. You need to sign the stipulation of agreement to pay out the monthly payment of $421.04, or a one-time fee of $1,500, basically. And I said, well, I can't do that. And he says, well, then you need to figure out how you're going to make it happen. And I said, well, I need to talk to my husband. He says, no, there's no time for that. You either sign this now, or there's going to be a knock at your door with the process server. And after a while, I kept thinking, I have nothing to support myself on this. I don't have any proof that this debt doesn't exist. And so I gave him my card number. Thinking about it and doing a little bit of research, I called him back and said, I need verification of debt. And he says, well, you lost that right when you didn't respond to that 30-day letter that we sent on December 15th. And I said, I never received it. And he says, I don't care. We sent it. And I said, this debt is time barred if this debt really exists. I don't know who you are. I've called my bank and I've canceled the card. And he says, well, we can't do anything anyway without you signing the statute or the stipulation of agreement. And he says, but when you do sign that, If you at some point do not make that payment, we are going to sue you for breach of contract. And it was at that point that I realized it's not about the debt, it's about suing me for breach of contract. So I immediately started filing complaints with the Better Business Bureau of California because they were out of California, the Consumer Protection Agency. Anyone and everyone, this is the only place that has offered me any support. Mm. Everyone says, well, can't do anything for you. Well, we'll file this, as Representative Pulvey said. They'll log the complaint, and they'll keep track of it. And this gentleman at the enforcement agency said, well, we are an enforcer, not a debt collector, so the laws that you're talking about, your rights, don't exist here.
Wow, fascinating. Thank you. Did you guys want to quickly add anything to the hearing?
Thank you, Beth, if you wanted to clarify any of the points that have been made earlier. Let's
see. So for the record, I am Eva Novick. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Oregon Department of Justice. And, you know, a lot of folks have already come before us, so we just wanted to make a few points to clarify Chair Fagan and members of the committee. A debt buyer is not the same thing as a debt collector. So when you're talking about laws that apply to debt collectors, sometimes they apply to debt buyers, but not always, because a debt buyer is someone who purchases a debt from a creditor and then attempts to either collect or resell that debt. Some debt buyers are collectors, but some debt buyers hire a collector to collect the debt on their behalf. So we want to make sure that those two terms don't get intermingled improperly when we're having this discussion. The second thing is when we're talking about what information a debt buyer has, that has changed somewhat over time based on contracts and based on changes in some federal law and other regulation. But we still believe that before a debt buyer should be collecting on a debt, they should have the information to support that they are the owner of that debt and that they have the correct amount of the debt in order to collect it. And most of the time, consumers don't respond because they don't know that this is something that they owe. Usually the first contact is through a lawsuit, and they see something that they don't recognize, and they figure, somebody just served the wrong person, and I don't have to worry about it. And so we want consumers to understand that they do need to respond. When we're talking about statute of limitations, in Oregon, statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, which means that the consumer actually needs to appear and say, this is past the statute of limitations, otherwise a default judgment can still be entered. So if you have further questions, we are always happy to answer those.
Thank you very much. Your analysis is really helpful. And if you heard anything else, even if you guys look at the hearing again, anything you could submit by tomorrow at 5 would be very helpful on your analysis. So,
Chair Fagan, thank you. I'm sure we will be doing that. And just for the record, we are continuing in negotiations and happy to be at the table. But just for the record, we would oppose 3057 as it's written now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Marquis, would you like the final word? You look like you were getting called to the principal's office or something.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association, an association of mostly Oregon domiciled collection agencies. I'm going to be very brief. I know your time is very short. I just want to thank the chair and others for the work group, and I'm appreciative of being a part of that. I'm hopeful that we can come together with something that makes sense. I think we're very close and addresses many of the problems that we're faced today. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thanks. Right. And I am going to leave the record open until 5 o'clock tomorrow. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard? Arthur Towers, come on in. Couldn't let Matt have the last word, huh?
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, in a word, yes, that's correct. Arthur Towers with OTLA. And I just want to put ourselves on the record as being very much in favor of 2252 as written. We've been appreciative of being a part of the conversation. Look forward to the next wave of conversations. And there are some things I'd like to straighten out for the record. And I'll do that in writing before tomorrow at 5.
Thank you very much. Great. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2252 and House Bill 3057. And we're going to carry over House Bill 2909 to Tuesday. And I think, can we quickly at least just adopt the amendments in the two work sessions, and then we'll Yeah. Is that okay? Okay, cool. So I'm going to quickly open a work session on House Bill 2637. And I understand there's a dash 2 amendment. Do you want to give us a quick update on that?
Yes, Madam Chair. For House Bill 2637, there's a dash 2 amendment that prohibits a person advertising mortgage credit products from omitting to identify themselves, requires advertisers to keep copies of all advertisements for 24 months, makes failing to keep such records an unlawful trade practice.
Great, and I was informed by Mr. Cosgrove that industry is supportive of the amendment, and that Mr. Lively signed with the amendment, so I think this was a consensus amendment. So with that, I will entertain a motion on the amendment. Dash 2.
Madam Chair, I move we adopt the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2637.
Representative Holvey has moved that we adopt the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2637. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so adopted. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill
3-
close the work session on House Bill 2637. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3031, and there's a dash 5 amendment. And I will actually just give a quick, just to be brief. So this is just an amendment. It's a consolidation of multiple requests. One was from the Collectors Association, actually, that's already otherwise regulated to not be subject to, and again, this was my bill on the automatic robocalls requiring that opt out within the first 10 seconds of the call. And there was also an amendment here. It includes the Attorney General's amendment, and it also includes an amendment requested by Sprint and AT&T to allow them to still call customers where there's an existing business relationship. So those are, and kind of the policy being, this bill is targeted at the robocalls that are kind of otherwise not regulated, and so a couple industries came forward that their calls are already regulated to be kind of removed from this additional requirement. So we're not going to work the bill today, but if we could, I would entertain a motion on the dash 5.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash 5 amendment to House Bill 3031.
So Representative Holvey has moved to adopt the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3031. Is there any discussion?
No.
Is there any opposition?
No.
Okay, seeing none, so adopted. And with that, I'm going to close the work session, House Bill 3031. Anything else for the good of the order?
No.
Okay, I'm going to close.
Oh. Still want to carry these.
Yes.
Over.
So I am also going to carry over the work sessions on House Bill 3031 and House Bill 2637 to Tuesday. And with that, I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Thanks for hanging.